Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A faction of Republicans in the House are refusing to even vote on the Senate.
I know the president's worried about his next election, but my God, shouldn't we be worried about the country?
In the 65 years after the end of World War II, this is the most difficult crisis for Japan.
The United States was actually doing relatively well until Italy ran into trouble.
The Brian Lehrer Show, December 27th, 2011. We'll talk about the news of the day and the news of the year, some of which you just heard recapped in those clips, beginning with New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent and WNYC contributor David Sanger and Melinda Henneberger, political reporter for The Washington Post. Hello, you two. Welcome back to WNYC.
And how are you, Brian?
Good. I was wondering which greeting should I use? And so I know, let me be the first to wish you both a happy new year. How about that?
Well, thank you, Brian.
That's a
great start, since we're all still cleaning up from the mess of the weekend Christmas, right?
That's right. From Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, solstice. Does anybody give solstice presents? I'll bet somebody does.
Present is that the days get longer.
That is.
I used to go listen to the Hallelujah chorus. Does that count?
Sure, that counts. A gift to yourself. And David, you get our half glass full award for saying the days are getting longer. All right. As you both know, here's where we're going to start today, and we will open this up for our listeners as well. What is your nomination for the most significant national political development of 2012? That is, what had the most impact on D.C. or our national politics in terms of who gained influence and who lost influence? Because that's the definition of politics: who gained influence and who lost it. Not just politicians, but it could be, you know, groups of the American people measured in your percentage income level or however you want to do it. So, listeners, the question is for you two. What's your nomination for the most significant national political development of 2012? That is, of 2011, what had the most impact on D.C. or our national politics in terms of who gained influence and who lost it? And we will have a quota on the number of you who can say Occupy Wall Street. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Melinda, you want to throw one out there?
Well, I'm glad you said it was 2011 and not 2012. I was worried about my crystal ball here.
We'll come back next year and do the same thing, and I'll say the right year.
I really think it probably was, at least the way I see it, the gridlock that completely kept, you know, deficit reduction talks failed because there just wasn't the ability to give on either side this grand bargain that I truly believe both Boehner and Obama had high hopes for. It didn't happen. The super committee, not so super after all. There just really wasn't an ability to move forward because, you know, on the one side, Republicans just didn't want to see anything, give anything on the, in terms of revenue, taxes. And the Democrats then felt like, why should we give on entitlements when we don't see anything on the other side? But in terms of who gained and lost power, I do think that we see in the president's improved approval ratings and, you know, what we see in terms of the prospects for 2012 election, I think we really do see that that wild gridlock hurt both parties. I think it hurt Republicans more.
David Sanger?
Well, you know, I'd agree with my great friend Melinda, but, you know, too much agreement on a show like this is never a good thing. So let me... And I actually think that the failure of the president's bipartisan group to come up with a budget deficit over the long term will have the greatest effect, because we're just not good at doing long-term planning in this country at a moment that many of our competitors are getting better. But for the purposes of argument, let me make the case that at least in the short term, Occupy Wall Street, before you throw on your quota, did change the balance of political power in the country. And the reason I say that is that until that time, throughout the rest of the first half of the year, the Tea Party thinking that the problem that the country faces is too much government and too much regulation basically went unopposed. And Occupy Wall Street was the flip side of the same coin. It was the argument that, in fact, the problem was too little regulation that had allowed both a perversion of the capitalist system, and at various moments the pendulum has swung between government regulation and capitalism, and also had contributed to income disparity. And by the end of the year, you heard both of those views being debated in about equal measure. And at the first half of the year, you did not. So I think that they may win the award for swinging the debate, at least over the short term.
Right. And my nomination, I guess, echoes that a little bit, which is the Tea Party's power peaked and began to wane in 2011. We saw the beginning of the end with the House Republicans backing down in the payroll tax standoff just last week, while President Obama's popularity went up. And this may have been moderate America beginning to say enough to the Tea Party absolutists. So we've got those three out there. We've taken instant notes. We have a producer / stenographer in the control room who has instantly written them up. And listeners, you can vote or nominate your own most significant national political development of 2011. On our website, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. You'll see the 2011 Top Stories page, and you can vote for David's or Melinda's or mine nomination for, and there it is, it's up already. The poll is up for top most significant national political development of 2011, or nominate your own at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we'll get back to the big national question and see whose nominations are winning in a little bit. But, Melinda, I want to turn to some news of right now, because we are combining news of the year and news of what's going on right now. While people were decorating their trees and lighting their menorahs, they may have missed that Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry both failed to get on the ballot for the Virginia primary. They didn't have enough valid signatures by the Friday deadline. How big is this for the Republican presidential primary race?
Well, I think it's symptomatic of the problem, since Newt is, at least for the moment, leading in the Virginia polls. The fact that he couldn't get on the ballot in his home state just really shows what organizational problems he has. I mean, he has complained not too surprisingly, that the process is so onerous. Not only do you have to have 10,000 signatures, but you have to have 400 in each of the state's 11 congressional districts. However, he had since July, you know, at a time, I don't know if he was still cruising around the Greek islands or just back, but he had since July to start collecting these signatures. So I think it really does show an organizational weakness that's part of a much bigger story than just what happens in Virginia, which is an important state.
Although, David, I don't know if you ever write about ballot access laws, but I think it does bring up a question of ballot access rules and how hard it is and how hard it should be to get on in any particular place. And this is an issue locally, too, because New York State has very restrictive ballot access rules, New Jersey less so. But in Virginia, you need 11,000 signatures overall, including 400 registered Republicans in each of the 11 congressional districts in the state. So they spread it out like that. It's not just 11,000 signatures. At least 400 have to come from each of the 11 congressional districts. And I think that's designed to throw up obstacles to candidates who don't have a lot of money, which means candidates who aren't supported by the party establishment, even if you're number one in the statewide polls, as Gingrich was as of Friday.
Well, it does raise this issue, and you'll notice I saw in the Washington Post and some other local media here in Washington that you are now seeing even some Democrats, some of whom probably have a somewhat malicious interest in seeing the Gingrich candidacy keep going as far as they can, begin to challenge whether or not these rules are too restrictive. But remember, we're talking here about a primary, And primary rules are set frequently by the party. And so there is obviously some role for the state, but by and large, parties around the country get to control a fair number of their own rules for how a president ultimately gets nominated. Raises another question beyond Gingrich himself, though, which is Rick Perry. You know, we've all believed for a long time that Gingrich was, you know, a one-man show, not much of an organization. When Perry first came into this race in the summer, the thought was that he would bring a fairly prodigious organization and a lot of money. And it does raise the question of why, in a state that is so crucial to Republicans as Virginia, that Perry himself also didn't manage to get his act together for this one.
Talk about an instant flameout. I wonder how Rick Perry even goes back to being governor of Texas and look his state's people in the eye with as much of an embarrassment as he has been to himself in this primary process. But Melinda, are we finally seeing a bull market in Rick Santorum shares in Iowa?
Well, I just want to weigh in before I get to that on Rick Perry. I'm sure you saw where the Houston Chronicle has been begging him to come on back home and stop embarrassing the state. But Rick Santorum,
which also,
I think,
by the way, raises the question, considering who our previous president was, of how do people get to be governor of Texas? Like, how qualified or how knowledgeable about the world at large is it okay not to be?
Well, he got to be governor of Texas by the fact that the previous governor got elected president of the United States. So, you know, that was his way in.
But
well,
we digress.
He was seen as a very powerful governor in Texas. I mean, he kind of outfoxed himself in a way, in that he rarely debated in his statewide races. And, you know, that's a skill he might want to have brushed up on a little bit more. But back to Santorum, he really has been doing better in polls recently. He said it would be fine with him if he were the last one to get to be the flavor of the month. And I think he inspires a little bit of guilt in Republicans. I mean, he does have a completely conservative record. He was the first to make it to all 99 counties in Iowa. He, you know, unlike some others, has really done retail politics in the state where, you know, we've always said that matters first.
He's also basically scandal-free and flip-flop-free.
That's correct. He, you know, has this unimpeachable personal life. And, you know, on the life issues, you know, has certainly made that the centerpiece of his entire political career. So he now is seeing a modest bump in the polls and has gotten some really important endorsements, including Bob Vanderplatz, who's an important evangelical voice in Iowa.
So here is Rick Santorum. Let me play a clip of Rick Santorum himself doing political analysis of his own place and everybody's place, really, in the upcoming Iowa caucuses.
There's the Libertarian primary, which Ron Paul is going to win. And then you got the moderate primary, which Gingrich and Romney are scrumming for. And you got three folks who are running as strong conservatives. And, you know, I think if we win that primary, we're in very good shape as the non-Newt Romney.
And, David, that spin is to Santorum's benefit, but he's kind of right, isn't he? There's, you know, the Libertarian primary, which is Ron Paul versus nobody. There's the moderate primary. He's spinning Gingrich as a moderate there, but it's Gingrich
right,
and Romney. And then there's the social conservative primary, or caucus, in the case of Iowa, which I think is all important to Santorum. And, yeah, people are going to choose between him and Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry.
Right. And what this may tell you is that for all of the noise we're going to hear in the next week or so, Iowa may not mean very much at the end of this process. Now, Melinda is much more expert in this subject matter than I am. But it strikes me that Iowa, because it's a caucus and not a primary, because it has more to do with, you know, who you can bus and who gets organized, and because Iowa itself is both less prone to some of the problems that the country is having, economic problems that the country is having, and because it has this very, very motivated conservative core, may not be all that representative. And I'm not sure by the time we're all done with this that how the Iowa primary sorts out this set of candidates is going to turn out to be that important.
Melinda, you agree?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the fact that McCain finished fourth in Iowa shows you that it needn't be as conclusive as we pretend, you know, in the early months of the primary process. But what Santorum really wants to do is be the surprise. He wants to be the news of the night. So if he performs better than, you know, the sub-basement expectations that the media has set for him, in his view, then he can come out of there and finally, you know, start raising some real money and go forward into the states to follow, into New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida. So his goal is to be the surprise of the night, even if he does super well coming in, you know, next to last above Huntsman.
We'll continue in a minute talking about the news of December 27th and the news of 2011 with Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Post, David Sanger, and political reporter for the Washington Post. What did I say? Sanger for the New York Times, Melinda Henneberger for the Washington Post, and you. Call us up with your most influential political development of 2011, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What really mattered? Stay tuned.
We can say to those families who have lost loved ones to Al-Qaeda's terror, justice has been done.
And I believe these words came from the Pokemon movie.
This is a president who fundamentally believes that this next century is the post-American century.
And I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
Some more of the voices of 2011. And tomorrow, folks, we've got a special show for you to end the year. And if you've been paying attention to the clips today, you're going to be in a better position to succeed at it. It's our annual end-of-the-year news quiz. Were you paying attention in 2011? We will find out. And then on Thursday, no guests, just you and me. I'll bring some good questions if you bring some good answers. Is it a deal? So a lot to listen for all this week, including tomorrow, our annual end-of-the-year news quiz, including prizes. Were you paying attention in 2011? But right now we're paying attention to New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent David Sanger and Melinda Henneberger, political reporter for The Washington Post, as we talk about some things going on right now and the news of the year in review. And the question on the table for them and for you, what was the most significant political development of 2011 in terms of who really gained influence and who really lost influence? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And of the three of us started with, surprise, surprise, David's nomination of Occupy Wall Street is winning in a landslide in terms of what our listeners are voting for. But let's dwell on that for a minute. Melinda, what does it really mean? I mean, obviously, Occupy was a big thing, and, you know, arguably the most important political development in terms of what the news media talked about. But what about in Washington? There were Occupy encampments this fall in so many cities and towns, but has it had an impact in Washington, even on the Democrats in Washington?
I think so, very much so, actually. And I think that's because the new focus, as David mentioned earlier, on income inequality has so mirrored what we saw going on in the national debate, with, you know, Democrats talking about a tax on millionaires and the so far refusal on the other side, you know, to look at that and their preference for calling that class warfare. I mean, it was this new focus on income inequality really was at the center of the conversation this year, and it has very much affected, I think, where the Democrats might try to go in the next year.
David, influence on policy?
You know, I don't think that we have yet seen much influence on policy. I think we have seen more influence on politics. But I think what it may have done is encouraged a group of largely Democrats, some liberals, who hadn't quite figured out how they were going to answer the big government charge. And you've heard President Obama begin to test this out for the 2012 campaign. And what his phrase has been is that if you basically took the position that that the Tea Party took, you would recreate the conditions that in the end led to the crash in 2008 and 2009. Absence of regulation, not paying attention to what was going on in the mortgage markets, not paying attention to the long-term effects of income inequality. And then he accelerated that through the end of the year. And as Melinda pointed out, you've now seen his numbers go up on this, when the Republicans got themselves in sort of the unbelievable position of opposing a continued tax abatement, not really a tax cut, for the middle class. And he suddenly had the issue that he wanted, which was the Republicans opposing a tax cut for a group that was not wealthy. And that seemed to build on the themes of the Occupy movement. Now, it's interesting that Obama has done that while never really embracing the Occupy movement. He kept his distance.
And what about the one that I threw out there, just to dwell on it for a second, the idea that the influence of the Tea Party may have peaked and is beginning to wane? You know, that perhaps we don't see the Tea Party in the streets anymore. We see Occupy Wall Street in the streets. Maybe that's only because they already managed to take over the House of Representatives, so they don't have to go into the streets, Melinda. But maybe the Tea Party started to get its comeuppance when the House had to back down on the payroll tax impasse the other day. And maybe that, you know, maybe middle America is becoming skeptical of the Tea Party's absolutism now.
Maybe, but I do think it was pretty stunning to see, you know, John Boehner have to have this reversal where in 24 hours where he, you know, they had a deal on the payroll tax, then 24 hours later they didn't, and then they were forced by public opinion and maybe more to the point by the Wall Street Journal's editorial page to come around. But the fact that, you know, the Tea Party elements on Capitol Hill seem more in charge some many days than John Boehner, I think, shows that they still have a lot of clout.
David, anything on that?
Well, the Republican establishment spent most of the year basically trying to figure out how to handle the Tea Party caucus, because the caucus was about everything except compromise. And at the end of the year, of course, they had to compromise because it's the way you actually get legislation through. So refusing to compromise sounds great out on the campaign trail and fundamentally doesn't work when you get to Washington, and hasn't over the 200-plus years of the Republic. And I think that you saw Boehner sort of caught between his knowledge of that reality and his effort to try to keep the caucus from basically taking, or the Tea Party side from taking over his entire caucus.
Chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, David Sanger, political reporter for the Washington Post, Melinda Henneberger, as we talk about some of the top political developments of 2011. We'll get to a little international stuff, too, coming up. But let's take some of the calls that are coming in that are not about Occupy or Tea Party or the gridlock, which was obviously the nexus of national politics in the nation's capital. But let's hear what some other people's nominees are. Frank in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was thinking that this would be categorized as the year of the hypocrite, because we have Democrats that are putting in power the national security where you can detain people, and then you have Republicans that are being blamed for the 99%. But if you have 100% of people and 99% of them are poor, then how is it all one party's fault when the president is the Democrat?
Thank you very much. Let's go on to Reba in Manhattan. Reba, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, I believe it was Ron Wyden disgracing himself by allying himself with that right-wing crackpot monster, Paul Ryan, who wants to destroy Medicare. He is now giving Ryan cover for his proposals for vouchers or premium support and helping him get reelected in a district where he's not popular. I believe that this alliance, now people can say, well, it's bipartisan, and I think it means that this is the first step in the destruction of Medicare as we know it.
Reba, thank you very much. Melinda, how about that one? Paul Ryan this year did propose basically the complete privatization of the Medicare system, and he's no ordinary congressman. He's the chairman of the House Budget Committee, so this is a major proposal, which I think actually passed the House, didn't it? For the complete overhaul of Medicare, looking into the deficit future, et cetera, et cetera, and turning it into a voucher system. And then just in the last week, we had Democratic Senator Ron Wyden embrace basically the idea, as long as there's a Medicare public option also available to people. How big a thing is this?
Well, the view expressed by the caller is certainly why Democrats have to think twice and three times before giving any quarter on the doing anything to Medicare. And then you have someone like Newt Gingrich, who's called the Ryan Plan right-wing social engineering. So it's not that there is unanimity of opinion on what to do on that on the Republican side either. You know, what that means for the Democrats in general, voters say that they want compromise, but whenever a politician like Wyden tries to find it, then partisans don't like it. So, you know, these guys have a tough job, don't they?
Indeed. On our comments page, Alicia writes, I think one of the most important developments of 2011 is the passage of indefinite detentions in the defense bill. That this bill passed nearly unopposed when it goes against several constitutional amendments signals a very scary time in the history of this country, according to that listener's opinion. And we talked last week about how President Obama has said he will sign that bill for indefinite detention of terrorism suspects, including American citizens. And the window of difference between his policies on these kinds of things and President Bush's is becoming smaller and smaller despite the 2008 campaign. David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi there. Well, nobody's going to argue about the importance of Occupy, but Occupy started in September 17th, and before Occupy, there was Wisconsin, and 14 brave Democratic state senators went on the lam to fight for workers' rights, and hundreds of people then moved in to occupy the Wisconsin state capitol. And I think that was a harbinger of Occupy, and it'll be interesting going forward seeing the interplay between the Occupy movement, the labor movement, and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
David, thank you for that. The prehistory of the Occupy movement in Madison, Wisconsin. David, turning to the international and American politics, the Obama team, obviously the Arab Spring was a top development in the world this year, one of the biggest developments arguably in world affairs in decades. But I'm curious how you see the Obama administration's response to it. Was there a consistent approach to the turmoil, to the change, as seen through American foreign policy goals or American values?
You know, Brian, and we've talked about this some during or earlier in the year, there wasn't a consistent approach, and I'm not sure one was possible. But let's talk for a moment about how President Obama himself handled it and then what happened when American interests came into conflict with American values. He started off pretty tepid on this, and what's interesting is that most of his advisors, when the uprising began in Egypt, which, of course, followed the Tunisia uprising, most of his advisors suggested that he stay with Mubarak. And
he made the decision in the end that that wasn't tenable, that he'd be on the wrong side of history, and that in any case, the Egyptian military wasn't sticking with Mubarak. So to hang on to an 82-year-old dictator who'd had some pretty big medical setbacks was not going to be putting Barack Obama where he wanted to be. But it wasn't until June that he came out with any kind of a speech that tried to knit together what the American position was. And in the end, what that position was is you have to handle each country individually, that in some places American interests are going to trump those values. And he said so quite explicitly. He deserves some credit for saying so. But in Bahrain, for example, the United States has been very, very quiet in its criticism of the royal family because we've got the Fifth Fleet there. In Yemen, while you're now seeing President Saleh likely to come to the United States for medical treatment, the U.S. was very slow to call for his removal because of concern about the counterterrorism interests. So in many places, you saw American interests trump American values, and while that doesn't go down well politically, it may not be the wrong position for the president to have taken.
It's funny because the Obama team, I think, took criticism from progressives for being too slow to embrace democratic change against dictators who are allies like Saleh or Mubarak. And the Obama team took criticism from the right for supporting change in too idealistic a fashion as they saw it when democracy might lead to anti-American Islamist regimes. Is there a conflict between domestic politics and international politics here?
There certainly is, but even within those who, within that group that was criticizing him for embracing democratic change when Islamists could take over, and by the way, the latest news from Egypt is that in the second round of voting, the Islamists did even better than they did in the first round, is that whole wing of conservatives have to get themselves around the problem of George W. Bush, who made the freedom agenda the number one issue of his presidency after the invasion of Iraq and the failure to find weapons of mass destruction. Think about President Bush's second inaugural address, which was all about the United States supporting democracy and freedom wherever it found it. Now, there is a part of the conservative movement that finds this somewhat disturbing because you can create open elections that people who were not part of the original revolution figure out how to exploit. And that's exactly what's happened with the Muslim Brotherhood and with the Salafists in Egypt and will probably happen in several other countries. But you can't have it both ways. You can't call for open elections and then complain that the result is a group that you find inimical to American interests.
Melinda, on the economy itself, we could talk about the politics of Occupy and the Tea Party all we want, but at the end of the day, it's the lack of jobs, it's wage stagnation, it's falling net worth of so many families because of home prices, it's the continued foreclosure crisis. Maybe the economy itself and its impact on Americans is the top domestic story of this year that really underlies the politics of gridlock and everything else that we've been talking about. And I think it dovetails with another real number one story of the year, which is increasing anxiety about permanent long-term decline in the U.S. economy rather than a tough cyclical recession. I think this is really defining and needs to be mentioned.
Well, you know what's interesting is how little Washington has concentrated on jobs, despite the fact that everyone has rightly said since the beginning that this campaign is going to be about jobs, 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 and that is top of mind for most Americans, and, you know, the terrible unemployment rate that has not really gone down much. Despite that, you know, that really hasn't been the focus of Washington, which is why, you know, what you were just talking about with the Obama's handling of the Arab Spring, I mean, that foreign policy is rarely touched on in Iowa. You certainly don't hear that talked about very much. You see someone like Ron Paul doing so well, even though, you know, he's a complete isolationist with views that are not mainstream in the Republican Party. And yet, I think it's surprising that with the economy where it is, you still see such focus on social issues during the Republican primaries, a lot more so than anyone thought we would.
All right. We're just about out of time. You each get one bonus question. Melinda, from the It Was So Long Ago, Even Though It Was This Year, That Almost Nobody Remembers file. And, of course, it was such a big and horrible thing at the time. The shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. A big outcry after that about civility in politics, but the shooter may not have been motivated by politics at all, except for the obvious horror of what this means for the Congresswoman and the other victims. Has this incident had any impact on the country?
It certainly hasn't in terms of the civility that you mentioned. But, you know, I think the bigger issue and the sadder thing is that we don't seem to, and terrible event like this doesn't seem to push us forward in dealing with the problems of mental health and treatment of mental health issues. And this guy, I think, clearly was not motivated by politics. He was a very ill person, and that's a problem that we have not really dealt with in many decades.
And David, bonus question for you. If we were in China, what do you think the top story of the year would be? I don't know if the state news agency Xinhua does top 10 lists, but what do you think the top story of the year would be if we were a Chinese family sitting somewhere outside Beijing?
Right. If we were listening to the WNYC equivalent in Beijing, Occupy Wall Street, people would be saying, Occupy what? And bipartisan agreement, they would be saying, what's bipartisan? For that, you need two parties. Instead, they would be talking about the pervasive fear in China that an economy that has grown at 8% a year has finally hit those boulders in the river. I was in China earlier this year. Inflation was the one thing everybody was talking about, just the price of vegetables as you went to markets. By the end of the year, what they were talking about was the fear of what would happen if growth moved down to just 5 or 6%. Now, we take 5 or 6% and run with it, right? But to them, 5 or 6% does not create the number of jobs they need in order to sort of keep the social peace, and certainly what is needed to keep the long-term plan going. And so that's, to their mind, the overwhelming story. What happens if the Chinese economy actually begins to act like the rest of the economies in the world?
And David Sanger, your pick, your nomination for top story in terms of political influence of 2011, which was Occupy Wall Street, was the hands-down winner among our listeners who voted on our website.
You know, I wish I could claim credit, but I have to tell you that was just too easy.
It was too easy. We were looking for something more subtle from you, David, but you went for the low-hanging fruit, and surely enough, 50% of our listeners voted for that as the top story of the year. The other 50% were all split among my nomination, Melinda's nomination, and the ever-popular Other. So congratulations, David Sanger. You can have a WNYC tote bag if you want.
Oh, great. Terrific. I could use one of those, actually.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and a contributor to WNYC, so I guess he gets the tote bag anyway. And Melinda Henneberger, political writer at The Washington Post. Thanks very much for coming on today. Happy New Year, both.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up after the break, we will take your calls. If you attended church over the weekend, this is for people who went to Christmas Eve or Christmas Day services, and we want to know whether your religious ceremony addressed any of the issues of our time that we've been talking about with David and Melinda or any others. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Was it more couched in the eternal messages of Christ, or did your priest or minister or whoever led the service at your Christmas Eve, Christmas Day services get political or get issue-oriented in any way? The Pope did. The Pope himself did. We'll mention that. What did you hear that was tied to the issue or issues of the day from the pulpit in the Christmas Eve or Christmas Day service at your church? Call us up and tell us what it was for you, what it was at the service that you attended. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We want to hear those stories. and we'll take them right after this.